So Nigeria goes to the polls on the 25th of February to elect the president, the vice president, the Senate and the House of Representatives. And because of this, we thought it would be a good moment to look at the geopolitics of Nigeria. Now, Nigeria was described as one of the MIC nations back in 2014 by Goldman Sachs. When analysing nations, they looked at the potential in the long term, which nations have the potential to move up the economic ladder and become a developed nation due to their latent potential. So the MINT, it stands for Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria, and Turkey. So here to give us a deep dive into the West African nation is our Africa correspondent, Omar Ahmed. Salaam, Omar, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. So I think, Omar, the best place to start is where we always start with these geopolitical discussions. What are Nigeria's geopolitical imperatives and geopolitical constraints?
So the geopolitical imperatives and constraints in Nigeria are basically, you know, ethnic and religious diversity, poverty and inequality, insurgency and terrorism, political instability, poor infrastructure, environmental degradation, population, and I believe these are the top seven. So starting with the ethnic and religious diversity, this is quite important because Nigeria was established based on this ethnic diversity problem. The reason I say that is because there was the northern part of Nigeria and the southern part of Nigeria. And in 1914, Lord Lugard just decided, Lord Lugard decided to unite Nigeria. You know, the infamous move that was known as the amalgamation of Nigeria. Now, that idea had been floating around for quite a long time before that. But as a result of that, Nigeria is now a home to over 100 ethnic groups, and they speak a variety of languages. They have totally different cultures and beliefs. This diversity has often led to tension and conflict, particularly along ethnic and religious lines. There are three top tribes in Nigeria: the House of Fulani, the Yoruba, and the Igbo. The House of Fulani are from the northern part of Nigeria mostly, and they are largely Muslims. And the Yoruba and Igbo are mostly in the southern part, and they are mostly Christians. The Yoruba has also a huge population of Muslims, but they are mostly Christians as well. So this has played a significant role in Nigeria's politics due to the lack of trust between the tribes and the religious aspects as well.
So, Omar, in terms of numbers, what are the sizes of these three key tribes, or the approximate sizes?
We could say that the House of Fulani cover over 30% of the population, whereas the Yoruba has around, I think, 15 to 20%, and the Igbo has less than the Yoruba. So which is like why you find the Igbo in every part of Nigeria, mind you, although their main station is in the southeastern part of Nigeria, but they are the lowest in terms of numbers among the three.
So, from what I'm getting, what you're saying is maintaining social cohesion between the tribes and then obviously managing competition for resources. These are Nigeria's key imperatives.
Yes, they are, because there has been a talk of restructuring. For many years, there have been talks about restructuring the political apparatus, the whole building blocks of the government, for many years now. So some politicians have been calling on the constitution to be changed, where the government will be shaped in a way that every region has control over its resources and its people. So it wouldn't be centralized like it is now. Every power is centralized with the federal government. It would be that this, the northern, the northeastern region, the northwestern region, southeastern and southwestern regions, those are four regions that we have. So each one would have its own governor that leads it. So, and this is as a result of this lack of social and political cohesion, where no tribe trusts the other and no region trusts the other.
Mm. So, Omar, why is Nigeria such a tribal society or defined by its ethnic identity? I mean, it's a very European way to look at this, that why have nations should be based on one nationality. But why would you say the tribe is still the dominant feature in Nigeria?
Well, I think it goes back to the nature of the country's formation. In 1914, Nigeria was infamously amalgamated by Lord Lugar, as I mentioned. But this idea was previously suggested by George Goldie, who founded a chartered company and helped Britain secure northern Nigeria. The British colonial government had always favored the north, who are mostly Hausa Fulani. Now, this might seem like, okay, suddenly mentioning how the British government had favored the north. This is because the northerners formed the first Nigerian military under the colonial government. It was Lieutenant Holly Glover who decided to create an army dominated by the northerners, to the extent that other tribal members joining the army had to learn Hausa and serve under Hausa commanders. They were even called Glover's Hausas. So it also, this favoritism also saw the northerners clinch the power, the powerful positions during independence. So it can't be by chance that this seeded hatred between the three major tribes, that's the Hausa, Yoruba, and Igbo. This also ensured, even if by accident and for the sake of argument, suspicion and mistrust among the tribes, and further tilting the scale in colonial favor. After all, it was not the first time the British deployed the divide and conquer approach, which somewhat ironically involves uniting starkly dissimilar ethnicities under one rule and providing them with no plausible reason to stay so, meaning to stay united. So you can see that there was a coup. The first republic, as they like to call it, that was headed by the first and last prime minister of Nigeria, Sir Abubakar Tafawa Balewa. They were mostly headed by northern Nigerians and a few southern Nigerians. Like, the prime minister was killed. The Sadona of Sokoto, who was the leader of the northern region, was also killed in the January coup of 1966. This was the harbinger to the war, to the Biafran War. Actually, there was another coup 6 months later, but this first coup was the harbinger to the Biafran War. So it seems like it was a clash between the Igbos and the Hausas or the rest of the countries. But honestly, it's not that. It's just the tribal. It's just the tribal differences. The people didn't know why they should be together. Everyone wanted power for himself. The Hausas were thinking if they didn't have power, they would be suppressed. And so were the Yorubas and so were the Igbos. But you need to understand, when I say the Hausas, I mean the North. Because the other tribes, there are like many other tribes in the North that were represented by the Hausas. There were many other tribes in the South West that were represented by the Yorubas, and many other tribes from the Southeast represented by the Igbos. So for instance, President Goodluck Jonathan is always seen as an Igbo, but he's actually not an Igbo, he's an Ijo. And but they come under the Igbos and things like that. So Nigeria is heavily divided simply because they were united in order to...
What's the difference between the Ijo tribe and the Igbo tribe?
They are completely different in the sense that their language is different, their culture is not completely similar. It's not completely the same. It is similar, but not completely the same. But having said that, they live in almost the same areas. So at the international stage, they have no differences because they're thinking, okay, he is, you know, the son of the soil, as they like to say, you know, the son of our land. So no matter what, he is from us, so we need to support him. He is our representative. And that's the mindset. Whoever goes there, he's more than anything, he is first representing his own home, meaning his own region, his own people.
Mm. So Omar, you touched on military rule. So Nigeria, like many African countries, has spent significant period under military rule. So how has that shaped the country? Is the country better today under military rule? Is it worse? And what is the status of the military today?
So the military rule is a major talking point in Nigeria's politics, or rather history. On and off, the military has lasted over half days of independence. And the military had its first test of power when the opponent's prime minister of Abubakar Tafawa Balewa and President Nnamdi Azikiwe back in the 1960s tried using the military to oust each other from power. And the prime minister won at that time. But not long after, the prime minister and many other elite northerners were killed in a bloody coup attempt. 6 months later, northern military officials paid back by executing, by leading a pogrom against Igbo people against the southeastern military officials. Fast forward to the Ibrahim Badamasa Babangida years, and he's well known, he's famously known as IBB. The military became somewhat united because they had a common interest, which was oil money. So there wasn't much difference about, okay, you're Igbo, I'm Yoruba, or you're Hausa, or all this, all that. No, there was, because afterwards the oil was discovered and it was bringing in lots of money into Nigeria. So, and this united them in terms, because they had similar interests. And that's, this unity is at the top level, not at the common ground, not the common people. So, and the last military leader was Sani Abacha, who was a notorious dictator. He sold out to the oil companies and killed many to preserve their interests. He died in the late 90s, and a democratic government was established and was headed by a former military head of state, Olusegun Obasanjo. He was a former military head of state in the 1980s. And he has always been regarded as a democratic hero, because he led the transition from military rule to civilian rule at the time, which brought in Shehu Shagari to power, who was then ousted by the military regime of Muhammadu Buhari, who is coincidentally the current president of Nigeria, the outgoing president of Nigeria, President Muhammadu Buhari. He was also a military leader. So you can see how the military has had a huge influence in Nigeria's politics. And as a result, even after the establishment of democratic rules in 1999, the military figures that were at the forefront of military coups and executions became the leaders afterwards. So from 1999 to 2023, there have been two former military leaders. So you can see how that has had a huge influence.
These former military guys as civilian leaders, did they establish political parties, or are they just running on their own personalities?
So political parties have always been around in Nigeria. They've always been around. The military took power away from them many times. But political parties like PDP is the oldest political party right now in existence in Nigeria. And it was not established by military officials. Yet it ended up being influenced by former military officials. And of course, afterwards, many other political parties were created, like ANPP, CPC, which evolved into APC, which is the All Progressive Congress, which is the leading party now in Nigeria. So one could say that the military have now succumbed to the political class, the elites. But that does not mean they are completely impotent. But getting back into politics would be harder than in places like Sudan or Pakistan, because they haven't been directly involved for a long time with their identity as the military, because it was a complete detachment from military rule to civilian rule. IBB, who was a military leader, started all this transition in getting the military back into the barracks at a time when the whole military, when a large section of the military was politicized.
So, Omar, moving over to the economy, so Goldman Sachs was pretty confident about Nigeria's economy. How would you describe Nigeria's economy, and is it meeting the lofty opinion that Goldman Sachs had about it?
Back in the years when Nigeria's economy was growing faster than any in Africa, there were a lot of predictions that it will become this and it will become that, and which earned it a position in the mint block, economic block, or rather group. Because I remember at the time it was the largest African economy, growing faster than South Africa, which is a huge economy in this continent. But over the years, Nigeria hasn't diversified. It is heavily indebted. It has gone through two recessions in the last 8 years. The currency is significantly weak. It sells at around 500 naira per dollar in the official market and over 700 naira per dollar in the black market. This has seen the government undertake desperate initiatives to stabilize or at least reduce their regression, but to no avail. Right now, the Nigerian government doesn't even know what to do about the economy except incur more debt. Whenever it has a problem, it just wrecks in more debt into the economy. Recently, in order to help stabilize the value of the naira, the Nigerian government has moved to change the naira notes. This is in order to create a bit of scarcity to create a scarcity for the circulation of the naira, which has proven rather useless because the House of Assembly and the representatives are pushing for the old naira notes to coexist for a longer period of time. Now, but the issue with the economy is that...
So, Omar, I want to come back to the discussion of naira. But just quickly, Nigeria, although Libya has Africa's largest oil reserves, Nigeria is Africa's largest oil producer. What is the role, what impact is that having on Nigeria's economy? And do you see Nigeria's oil wealth potentially leading to the development of the country?
It hasn't for over 50 years, or rather 40 years, and I don't think it will now, which is why there has been a discussion. There have been discussions around diversifications, but they remain so as just discussions. You see, oil covers over 90% of Nigeria's revenue, which means any change, any reduction in the value of oil affects Nigeria's economy drastically. So during the good luck years, a barrel of oil was sold at $100, $130 at one point, whereas now it sells way under that, way lower than that, like maybe $50, $40, $30 as well. So Nigeria heavily depends on oil, and the value of oil globally is not as it used to be. So as a result of that, the economy became completely destabilized, because there is no way for it to earn more revenue, more money as a result, which affects the value of the naira. Because without exportation and the dollars coming in, the value of your currency gets heavily affected.
So talking about the naira, the currency, I believe that last year before, Nigeria tried its hand at the e-naira. Now, you can correct me if I'm wrong, this is a central bank digital currency or a cryptocurrency, but how has the e-naira performed?
Well, I live in Nigeria. All my life I've been in Nigeria, and I can tell you that I have actually forgotten that the e-naira exists until very recently, because the people are not digitalized, because it's a cryptocurrency centralized and backed by the Central Bank of Nigeria. But the problem is that when launching it, there was a lack of foresight, because consistent access to internet and the lack of digital literacy itself was a huge obstacle. So we actually do not have enough data, you could say, to measure whether the e-naira has performed well or it hasn't performed well, because people have not been using it in the first place. So this move to replace the naira notes and pull people move into a cashless policy, it's actually one of those things where the government wants people to start using the e-naira as a result of that. But people cannot even use mobile bank apps, efficiently. Even if they want to, they mostly do not have internet connection. They can't afford airtime and things like that. So these are things that seem simple, but they actually determined the fate of the e-naira. So as far as facts are concerned, the e-naira has underperformed heavily, and it is not expected to perform well in the next few years, unless the financial situation has changed for the people.
So am I correct in saying you're not as confident as Goldman Sachs is about Nigeria's economy?
Yes, I'm not. I'm sorry to Mr. Goldman Sachs, he's an expert, but no, I'm not. I'm not confident about it.
Okay, so moving on to security. From the outside, Nigeria comes across as pretty unstable. We hear a lot about Boko Haram, for example, carrying out attacks. Just describe to me, what's the security situation like on the ground? And also tell us a bit about Boko Haram. What is their struggle? What is the truth? How much area do they control? And what's actually going on the ground?
Yeah, so I will start with Boko Haram itself. Boko Haram has been operating since 2009, but it has been around way longer than that. It's around since the 90s, actually. but it never engaged in any military activities until 2009, just after its leader, Muhammad Yusuf, was executed by the federal government. Now, Boko Haram, as the name implies, because Boko is a Hausa word, and Haram is an Arabic word that has been integrated into the Hausa language. Boko means Western education. So anything related to science, reading and things like that, they are considered as Boko. So when they say, when the Hausa say Boko, they mean Western education. So Haram means prohibited. It's forbidden. So Boko Haram, meaning Western education, is forbidden. It's prohibited, meaning it's sinful when you engage in that. But this is a name due to a narrow view of their movement. Their movement was towards establishing an Islamic government, and they had a huge influence in the northeastern part of Nigeria, especially in the state of Maiduguri, where they operated. Where they had more influence and operated for most of their years, especially the early years. So in the last few years, one could say that their activities have watered down. So Boko Haram started in Maiduguri, and they have been militarily active since 2009. But recently, their activities have turned less damaging. Right now, the most dangerous security challenge in Nigeria is in kidnappers and bandits. The Washington Post even describes the kidnapping business as the fastest growing industry in Nigeria. Hundreds of millions are paid to ransom relatives. Communities in places like Zamfara pay hundreds of millions as tax to bandits. So Boko Haram itself has somewhat changed and has gone into this business of kidnapping people and sieging, and taking hostage a whole community where they collect taxes. And that's how they actually make money, literally.
Right. So would you say Boko Haram has really moved away from its original goals?
I would say that from the very beginning, we could say that the first batch of Boko Haram was on the goal of, eliminating Western education. As you can see, they have kidnapped children from schools, boarding school, like the one that made it international with the Chibok girls, that have not still been completely salvaged. But so yes, Boko Haram has shifted away from its main goal of establishing any form of Islamic government, because from the very beginning they were more interested in creating havoc, kidnapping government officials and bombing masajids and churches more than calling for an Islamic government.
Right. Okay. So, Omar, moving on to Nigeria's foreign policy, how would you describe Nigeria's foreign policy?
Well, simple. And that's actually quite simple, because it's not a huge part of what Nigeria and Nigerians are concerned about. Nigeria's foreign policy is aligned with the policy of the powerful nation its president is allied with. So it depends on who is the president and who is closer to. Is it Britain or America? France has been trying for years to get into the country, but to no avail. But right now, Nigeria is closer to the British. Hence, its activities in the western part of Africa or in any other place is mostly in alliance and in alignment with British intentions. But as a result of its alliance with Britain, you see that Nigeria has been trying its best has been struggling and striving to ensure it doesn't get heavily indebted to the World Bank, IMF, and Western-influenced financial organizations. Rather, it gets a lot of its loan from China and a lot of investments from China. It imports a lot from China as well. This is because Nigeria, like many other countries that are allied with Britain, it's trying to reduce the amount of influence the US can have on its economy as much as possible.
So, Omar, like most African countries, I'm assuming Nigeria is also taking a lot of money from China. Is the relationship with China restricted to economics, or does it go into the political realm as well?
Right now, China is kind of restricted to the economic aspect, because Nigeria owes China over 120 billion naira, and that's a lot of money, right? But China doesn't seem to be progressing towards the political aspect. As usual, it is still a paper dragon, at least in the African continent. But we need to wait for like a few years to see if China is going to move away from its non-violent aspect of politics or not.
Okay, so my final question for you, Omar, is what are the key medium to long-term challenges you see for Nigeria?
The most important is population. The increase in population, which brings into discussion poverty. There is a huge inequality in Nigeria's economy, and the population keeps growing. There are over 200 million Nigerians, and that's based on a consensus that was done more than over a decade ago. There's going to be another census in a few months, I think just after the elections. Another thing is, so this population issue is quite a big thing because there are more mouths to feed, but the economy is sliding down. It's slumping, okay? And then there's an issue of security and the possibility of a revolution, but that's in the long term. I mentioned revolution because, you know, there was the End-SARS protest in Lagos 2 years ago. And right now there are protests in southern parts of Nigeria, like the state of Ondo, due to the scarcity of cash in banks and point of sales, what we call POS. They are like local money dispensers that people use. So these Nigerians are quite upset and angry, but such revolutionary fervor has been largely curbed in Nigeria because the government is heavily allied with religious institutions, and Nigerians are quite religious, both Christians and Muslims. So they do follow what their clerics and Islamic scholars tell them to do, which is why revolutions have been curbed. But as time goes on, the upcoming generation are getting more frustrated because they are more ambitious than the current generation person. So the upcoming generation are more ambitious and they have all this vision to make money and build their own lives, and the economy is frustrating all that. In the long run, there is a huge possibility that Nigeria, or at least a part of Nigeria, will find itself embroiled in the violent protests.
So, Omri, you mentioned revolution. Are there chances in the long term of parts of Nigeria separating, becoming independent, because the growing population means there's a lack of resources or even political will to deal with them? What's the chance of parts of Nigeria separating?
There is a slight chance. And the reason I say slight chance, it's because although the majority of Nigerians would actually want the country to separate, but this is something that has been around since independence. And one thing I would like to mention, actually, just to establish a background for the point I'm going to make, is that it is usually assumed that the southern part of Nigeria that has most of the oil, most of the riches, it is usually assumed that they are the ones that want the country to separate. But as a matter of fact, the first people that called for separation were the northerners. They were the northerners, and they were protesting in the 60s, saying Araba. And Araba means separated, divided. It's Hausafo, divided. Because they are frustrated after, the prime minister who was from the north was assassinated, and Saudona of Sokoto, who was also from the north, was also killed. As a result, the Hausa people started calling for division and division. And then the southerners took it as well. Now, the northerners have united in the fact that they wouldn't want Nigeria to separate because most of the wealth comes from southern Nigeria. But in the past few years, oil has also been discovered in the few places in northern Nigeria, like Bauchi, like in local government here in Bauchi state. Oil was discovered and it has reached a commercial level. But at the top, at the national level, the elites, as you might say, the companies and the industries, the oil industry, wouldn't want Nigeria to be separated because that will have a negative impact on their economic interest as a result.
Okay, well, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to learn more about the issues raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolity.com, or all one word. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website, where you'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Adnan, and thanks for listening today.